Hello and welcome to the Vulture TV podcast. I'm your host, Gazelle Amami. In honor of last week's Emmy nominations, on this week's show, we're presenting Matt Zoller Seitz's recent conversation with the cast and creators of Better Call Saul at Vulture Festival. The AMC show picked up 7 nominations last Thursday, including Outstanding Drama and Acting Noms for Bob Odenkirk and Jonathan Banks. We'll be doing a longer discussion on all the Emmy contenders closer to the award show on September 18th. That's coming up, but first, if you have any questions for us or ideas for topics you'd like to hear, leave us a voicemail at 646-504-7673 or email us at tvquestions@vulture.com.
Oh, thanks, hon.
It's a little early, folks. Keep it down, will you please?
Thanks for coming out, folks. We are here, obviously, with the panel of actors and the co-creator of Better Call Saul, Ray Seahorn, Michael McKean, Peter Gould. I'm Matt Zoller Seitz. I'm the television critic for New York Magazine and Vulture. And joining us via phone is a certain attorney that you all know and love, Bob Odenkirk.
Hello.
Hello, hey. Bob.
Hey, Bob.
I can hear everything you're saying about me. And it's not true. I don't count my lines. I count other people's lines.
You got a mouth on you, Bob.
Hi. So, hi, New York.
Where are you anyway? Are you in LA?
I'm in the bathroom at home.
Say no more.
Perfect.
Not on the toilet. Jeez.
So there goes my first question. I thought I would start by asking Peter and Bob as well, I guess. You're coming into this from a show that was and is beloved, ran for 5 seasons, was a very big deal, and that seemed to have a complete and satisfying ending. And while fans were, I think, delighted or at least curious when this prequel was announced, naturally they wondered, how the hell are you going to do this? Was that a question?
Yeah, Peter, how are you going to do it?
Yeah.
Well, first thing we had to do was talk Bob into it. Bob had had a lot of questions, didn't you, Bob?
I did have questions, but, you know, I think that the concerns that I expressed, Peter and Vince had already been thinking about, obviously. They're always a couple steps ahead of everyone else. But the big concerns were, what kind of show would it be? And as it started, the guys were considering every option. And then concerns about, you know, is the character kind of likable enough? Because in Breaking Bad, he was very self-interested and, you know, he was funny, but maybe hard to follow for a while if he didn't grow some depth.
Yeah, and I think that was our great concern when we started thinking about the show, too. Frankly, I thought it was too good to be true. We started joking about it in the writer's room almost as soon as Saul Goodman was introduced, and it was a running gag. There's something that we want to do on Breaking Bad, and it seemed too silly, or especially if I was pitching, it was probably too silly. And the running joke was, well, we'll do that on the Saul Goodman show. And I always thought it was too good to be true. In fact, my experience in show business is nothing good ever happens, at least until Breaking Bad. Nothing good ever happened in show business, really, except for making...
Wow!
For me. Except for making...
That's making delightful. It's
hanging on by my fingernails.
Sergeant Bilko?
Sergeant Bilko. Well, that's...
Bilko and then
yes,
this.
Yes, that was it. Exactly. Well, you know, that's interesting. We actually did talk about Sergeant Bilko. And we can
do you have any idea what we're talking about?
No, they've never heard. Phil Silvers.
Wow, Bilko fans.
Yes.
All right, Phil Silvers.
They're known as Bilkies.
Bilkies.
Where my Bilkies at? You don't hear that ever.
No.
No, you don't.
I've totally lost the thread.
Are you
talking about show business? Nothing
that's
nothing
right.
Good ever happens.
Nothing good ever happens, and it's just it seemed too good to be true. So I was trying not to get too emotionally invested in it, and then especially because we were really preoccupied with Breaking Bad, and then when, you know, Vince and I started talking about it, and we were in this very unusual position for writers because usually you're going to a studio or a network and begging them to even, you know, hear your idea, and here we were in a situation where they were very interested in this, and so we had to kind of work it out for ourselves first. And the first idea we had was, I think I might have mentioned this, was doing a half-hour show, which would have involved bringing, the comparison we always made was Dr. Katz. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Yeah.
The
sure.
Great,
yeah.
The great
Jonathan Katz.
The Jonathan Katz, the great squiggle vision
very funny
show.
Man.
That was one. Were you ever on that?
No.
I'm surprised.
No.
That's how much he works. He's not sure.
That's right.
No, I did.
They may have recorded you and used your voice without telling you.
I did another animated show with Jonathan Katz.
That's well. Mm. It's a wonderful show. But part of our concern was if we did it as a shorter as a straight out comedy. Well, I had two concerns. One was the fun would come from the characters you bring in, and the thing that we came to realize was there's no show unless we're interested in the main characters, unless there's depth there. So we spent a lot of time trying to understand the paradox of this character, which was introduced as soon as he was introduced on Breaking Bad, which is the real name's McGill. I just call myself Goodman because the homeboys want a pie-pitting Jew. How did he get to that? What, you know, and the great question that we asked ourselves, and boy, I think we're finally on the way to answering it in the writer's room, is what problem does becoming Saul Goodman solve? And because that question is so weird and it's so hard to figure out, it's gotten up depth to it for us to continue working on. And I wasn't absolutely sure that the show would have emotional depth until actually these two, we came up with the idea of Jimmy having a brother, an older brother, Chuck. And then suddenly, what Bob is talking about is that Saul Goodman has nobody he cares about. He really has nothing to lose except his own life and money. And it's very hard, at least for us, to write a show about someone like that. And when we realized that Jimmy has this older brother who he really cares about, and who is really everything Jimmy isn't in so many ways, that started to humanize him for me. And then the idea that he had, that evolved, I think, more over the course of season one, that he had this wonderful, fascinating woman in his life. This beautiful, brilliant woman who's trying to pilot her own course. That just made it much more exciting. So I have no idea what the question was that you asked.
All right, you've answered it.
You answered it. I wondered if Bob could talk about that a little bit. The different challenges posed by this show. There's obviously a lot more, aren't there?
You mean just the idea of making the show? Because obviously Vince and Peter really, I let them.
No, I mean from you, just you filling this lead role, carrying the show, and also playing a character who is not only on screen more, but has many more layers than we were allowed to see.
Oh, that movie. Shit was easy. Piece of cake. The only, look, I mean, as long as they write it, I can do it. I don't think I could have made him care about Chuck if Chuck was just another lawyer and not his brother. I am taking care of this other lawyer. I love him. I don't know why. It was a wonderful challenge to have, a great gift to be given after all the years I spent in service of sketch comedy. To get to try to do this, but I don't think it was that different. It was just a couple steps up from the kind of work that you're always doing as an actor. I mean, that's how I looked at it. It's I don't know. It's almost so different that it is a different thing, but it isn't entirely. It's just taking the skills and the talents and the things I've been working with and seeing from Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul and all the actors I've been working with the last couple of years and doing, you know, putting my elbow into it and really, you know, working hard. I had to put in a lot of time, and I still do. I have to really focus to do it. And other than that, though, it's the same job. I mean, I could talk about the ways it's different, but as far as, like, being intimidated by it, I left that to Vince and Peter. I did not get intimidated by it, really, until they put the billboards up for the first season. I know you're laughing, and I can hear you laughing, but I mean it. I really literally went... I took it seriously, and I asked myself, you know, there were a lot of questions to dealing with it, but really, I didn't really let it freak me out until the billboards went up, and I thought, everyone's going to try this show because they all like Breaking Bad. It's not like you can fly under the radar with this first episode. You know what I mean?
Right. That's actually a good segue to talk about Chuck and what I like to call the Chuck issue.
Oh.
The Chuck issue. I love Chuck. I wrote a whole column in defense of Chuck. And I love Chuck as a character because Chuck, while he may lack what physicians might call a bedside manner, he's
a soul.
Or a soul. Oh. I don't think he's ever really been wrong about Jimmy.
No, he's been correct about Jimmy.
Yeah.
And he's doing the right thing by his lights, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with a very strange voice this morning. I think you know. No, I think his actions are supportable, are actually arguably correct. Doesn't make him nice,
right.
But you know, lawyers don't go into lawyering for niceness.
Well, no, and in fact, if I were to look for an attorney, I think I would much prefer to have Chuck.
Yeah. No, somebody actually asked me that question. If you were in trouble, who would you call? Would you call Chuck or would you call Jimmy? No question. No question. And what's really interesting is that there's nothing ruthless about Jimmy. Jimmy's heart is always getting in the way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that Chuck doesn't have a heart. He does have a soul, too. It's just that he's also got this growth that he has to have excised. And, you know, that's kind of a prime directive. You know, he's associating... I'm giving away way too much, not story-wise, because they don't tell us anything. But I think that he associates the presence of Jimmy with the absence of his good life. He's seeing some kind of sliding scale as he was seeing Jimmy more and more every day, that he was losing touch with other stuff.
We actually have a clip here that I would like to show. I think it's the last clip. It's the Chuck clip. This is from the season finale, I think from the opening moments of it. Can we play that? Okay. It's awkward, but it's back here.
Seriously, Chuck, we gotta eat it. Mom will be okay for a few minutes. It's been 3 days. It could be three more. Okay? Let's go, buddy.
Jimmy, you want to eat? Go eat.
I'll bring you something. Roast beef, no tomato, Italian on the side. Okay, be right back.
Ahem.
Mom. Mom?
Jimmy.
No, Mom, it's me, Chuck.
Jimmy.
No, Mom, it's me. So this is it, then?
That's one of the many scenes that I would show people to kind of encapsulate the whole range of emotions that you get on the show. Mm. It's wrenching. It's wrenching. It's so difficult to watch. Sometimes it's what I call cringe TV, where I'm kind of watching like this, and then you turn it back to light at the end, or you at least give people some relief. And yet people, despite this and despite other biographical back details, there are a lot of people who resent Chuck for standing in Jimmy's way. Are you aware of this?
Sure.
The fans, yeah.
Oh yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Well, they're wrong. Look, I just closed a show in Los Angeles Sunday night, and I played the worst person. This guy makes Jimmy look like a saint.
He was brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
Amazing.
I wasn't fishing.
Fish away.
I played this Southern colonel in the Civil War. This racist, slave-owning piece of shit. And this is like a brisk shower and a shave by a professional, which I took the other day too.
Oh.
Get my beard off, yeah.
Oh right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's huge beard.
And I even found a way to love that guy. I just think you have to find a way to love the person you're portraying to the degree that that person has regard for himself and that person respects his own opinions and his own rights, and you have to find the center of that person. You have to find, even if people from the outside see something awful, you have to make it something kind of, for you, doable and real. I worked with Helen Mirren one time. She played this awful person, and she said, whenever I have to play someone who's really detestable, I try and think of what was done to me to make me that way. What was the input that made this output what you get? And I think that by the end of the second season, you were answering all the questions close to what I was supposing. You were obviously filling in coloring in those spaces a lot more. But I always thought the mantra I had in the first season was, I made my mother proud, Jimmy made my mother laugh.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And it's like, on balance, I couldn't understand why his had seemed to have more value than mine. I mean, I had my law degree when I was 22 years old. Jimmy was still, with the Chicago sunroof at that age. I didn't get it. But it was playable. It was something that was really playable to keep at the center of it. And
And then he does that with your wife. And that seems painful.
I know. Yes, exactly. I mean, he's all over my shit.
Bob, how do you feel about that Jimmy Chuck relationship? What is it like to play, and how do you feel about it just as a viewer, if you can detach yourself from it at all, which maybe you can't?
Ask me that again, real quick.
Sorry?
Ask again.
How do you feel about the Jimmy Chuck relationship as an actor in those scenes, and how do you feel about it as a viewer, just with a little distance, if you watch the episodes on the air?
And I do watch it, and it feels a different experience from playing it. Sure. Part of that is because Peter and Vince continue to make the show even after we shoot it, which is pretty neat to see how they alter things all the way through the editing process. Yeah, I mean, look, it's this is like, I only have to play my side, so I don't have to think about the thing in total. I think that Jimmy's a little, he gets carried away with his enthusiasms and whatever's happening in the moment, and that helps me a lot to play those scenes with Chuck and to play a simpler character than Chuck is. Chuck's a more complicated mind. And I don't know. I think it's a true. I have a lot of brothers, and we don't have such rivalry. But there's such an intense closeness to your family, or can be, and certainly is with mine, that I think it all rings true. I don't know about the intensity of the resentment from Chuck towards Jimmy is hard for Jimmy to fathom, and I think it's. These are great scenes. They're wonderful scenes. They ring true all the way through, and I get to play them opposite Michael McKean, which makes me look like a real actor. that was true in Breaking Bad too, working with Cranston and Aaron and Anna Gunn and all. You know, it's the people around you who raise your game. So. I love playing those scenes. I could keep doing them, and they're extremely rewarding too.
Can we talk a little bit? Can we kind of return to an earlier subject, which is the idea of this as the story of the moral evolution of this guy? It's not just Jimmy who's going through it. It's not just Jimmy. Kim is going through it also, I think. And I would imagine that even Chuck deals with, although he's very resolute. The question of whether or not to cut his brother a break is something he must surely consider before setting it aside. And then you've got all sorts of other characters who are going through that. Is everybody on this show, in a way, you know, Mr. Chips at risk of turning into Scarface?
I hope they're not all following the same path. I think that, you know what, we try to think a lot about our character, the characters, and their choices, and who they are, and what they want to do. We also try to create contrasts between these folks. I mean, everything I say sounds like writing 101, but there's no writing 102, at least that I know. There's only the basics, and you have to go back to them. And one of the basics is contrast, and we're going to understand. As long as these characters are taking their own path, and they all have their own struggles, then hopefully that it creates more depth in Jimmy and a better understanding of Jimmy. The other possibility is that we just can only see, you know, just the way we work. And the way we think leads to certain results.
Well, I should clarify that.
It's also possible.
I don't want you to misunderstand, say that they're all the same character. I don't mean it that way. I just mean in the sense that when people ask me who's the good guy on this show, I don't want to tell them.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing though, and this is I struggle with this, is that people talk about morality as if all. This is going to sound like a Talmudic scholar here. They talk about morality, and they'll make comparisons that, to my eye, are ridiculous. Mm-hmm. They say, "Well, Kim is really just like Jimmy because Kim participated in this scam or that scam," and anybody can see. Well, there's a difference between, between staging a fake billboard, and possibly getting somebody to pay for an expensive bottle of booze. There are different qualities. We had this on Breaking Bad, where people would say, "Well, everyone's really, because Marie shoplifts, so it's really just the same as cooking meth." What? So I don't know. The truth is that we all have, and we try to use our own lives in this. Is that we all have our own struggles about, self-interest. And also, following the rules, and also, what do you owe other people in your life, Chuck has this way of thinking that's wonderful, because he has this wonderful ability to apply a very strict morality. And it's not just morality, it's about rules. It's about following the rules. And I have a lot, actually have a lot of respect for Chuck. And also, these characters are all, we're very lucky because these actors are so much fun to write for, and the characters are so much fun to write for. And so to make it sound like we've got it all planned out is maybe doing the show a disservice, because a lot of it is about a process of playing the game that we've established and trying to be true to where these folks are. I don't know if that answers your question. Is this about a moral descent? And that's a very good question. And I think that we'll find that out as the seasons go on, because Kim and Chuck are both going to be faced with a lot of tough choices. And it's possible, I personally think it's possible that any of these characters could maybe not have a moral descent. Maybe there can be redemption. People get better as well as getting worse. Mm. It doesn't all move in one direction. So that's I think a lot of it is to be continued.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about Kim in relation to these questions?
Nope.
I mean, she's somebody who. All right.
Bye.
See ya.
It's all about this. Slip her a 20.
Yeah.
Talk about Kim in the issues of morality.
Yeah, and also just the way that she's trying to make her own way in the world.
Right.
She's trying to make her own way in the world, and it's very, very difficult for her because she's a woman in this all-male firm, and also she is just not. She doesn't really seem to fit in there. Jimmy at least realizes that he doesn't fit in there.
Right.
I mean, what are some of the characteristics of Kim, and what are some of the issues that you are dealing with when you think about how to play these scenes?
I think you're right too, and by right I mean because it aligns with what I thought.
But of course.
the perception that she seems like a little bit of an outsider where she is too, and I think that that's one of the similarities that she shares with Jimmy. And when people would ask me at first, like, how are those two people together? They seem so different. I always saw more about them that was alike. I think that they're both a little bit, they're both loners in a way. They're both kind of outsiders trying to fit in, and they both, in some cases, literally know the right suit to wear and the right mask to wear for the environment you're in. And she is trying to fit in. And I tell people sometimes, the specific artistry that goes into the whole show is deeper than even the viewers see. Jennifer Bryan, our brilliant costume designer, right? Jennifer! Woo! We talked about that. When I went in for my first fitting, instead of it being about anything that you might get in some other fittings that I've had in my career, that's about low-cut shirts or, like, what kind of hot pants does this person wear? She said, I think Kim's trying to fit in, but she can't afford the suits they're wearing yet. Mm. So even though you'll be wearing navy blue and black, the audience won't be able to see it, but I want you to know that I think they should be mismatched, because she still buys separates at Marshall's and Nordstrom Rack, trying to look like she has the full suit, and I literally started crying. To have conversations about character at your costume fitting,
yes.
And to know that that's how much everybody is rowing this ship,
right.
Is a beautiful experience for an actor, and I think for the whole crew, because you really feel this, you know, it's at its very, very best. I'm aware of Vince and Peter being two of the best people that could helm a ship ever. I'm aware of that. But I'm also aware that they think that this is a collaborative art form. And you feel that when you're on set, and you feel that when you're with the crew and when you're prepping. That being said, I do think she's trying to fit in. And I like what Peter was saying. I think that they're the danger to any of these characters, I think, is when they think things are black and white. And I understand the comfort it gives all of us, and I think the audience feels this when you think about things in black and white terms, like if I just keep my head down and work hard enough and try to do the right thing, things will be okay. And that's not true. And it's unsettling when that's not true. And it's not true for Kim. And Jimmy, she needs Jimmy as much as Jimmy needs her, I think. I do not think it's a one-sided street at all. And when he tells her, people do have personal agendas. People do have ulterior motives. You can't just say, like, nope, I'll pick myself up and I'll fix this and I'll do it myself. He warns her of those things, and he was right in many respects, that there are things at play going on in her world that she can't fix on her own just by working hard enough and trying to do the right thing. And she's wrestling with that gray area. And I think that that makes her more accessible to the audience, that it's not just about being flawed, it's about the struggle to decide. Your moral compass, unfortunately, won't stay on north when you move. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it just depends on who's standing in front of you. And it depends on what the situation is. And that's the possible danger or the possible redemption for all of us, is when you go, all right, it's gray. Everything is gray. Now what do you want to do?
It's interesting to me, hearing you talk about this, that the two most, arguably the two most important people in Jimmy's life are both people who are constitutionally almost incapable of asking for help. Huh. Hmm. Chuck and Kim.
She's definitely a little anti-asking for help. And so is Chuck, and both of them get forced into positions where they have to accept help.
Yeah, but Chuck feels he's entitled to it.
It's true. Well, Chuck helped
his brother.
Yeah.
You know, Chuck got his brother out of jail.
Right.
Season one.
Yeah.
I feel like Chuck has been...
And implies it's not the first time.
Chuck has been there for Jimmy all through Jimmy's life when he really needed him. Right.
Well,
so I think maybe it does roll the other way.
But it was easy when Jimmy was a soft target.
Yeah. Mm.
When Jimmy was not an active participant in my life, it was very easy, because then he was an infant. He was a blob, you know. But the more spine...
Bob can hear you say that.
hi, Bob.
Hey, Bob.
He's back in the bathroom. No, but I mean, I'm saying that when Jimmy was just a problem that I was, that I had to take care of, that was easy. When Jimmy became a lawyer, it became a very strange nightmare. Mm. It's different. It's different. Time changes things.
Bob, what do you think of all this? Are you there?
No.
Did we lose him?
Fast asleep.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about you were talking about the intricacies of the wardrobe decisions,
yes,
for example.
No white buttons. You will never see men's shirts with white buttons on our show.
Why I didn't is know that. Why is that?
She hates them.
Yes,
especially
no character narrative story at all.
Especially a black shirt with white buttons.
Oh, any kind, anything other than a white shirt that has white buttons on it sends her right up the wall.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
And as far as the fitting, another costume thing, as far as the fitting, and you see it only in, I think, only like one scene, and it's when he finally busts the Kettlemans and is sitting on their fireplace area in season one. You finally see his shoes, which are one of my favorite things, and they're either Ferragamo or Gucci, the horse bit loafers, you know, that has the two metal rings and the bar, and one of his is being held together by a paperclip. And they're like really old and worn out. And I swear, like, if there was ever, we had a couple of really early calls, and maybe the first run of the scene, you're like, you know, trying to make sure you're very present in the scene. And I would just look at his loafers, and I knew instantly why Kim loves Jimmy. He's fucking holding it together with a paperclip. my heart would break.
Great. We actually have a clip here that has a production design detail that I love. It's the one with Mike. Do you see the one? I think it's number, it's not the first one, it's number two. The one with the truck.
Oh.
Oh, the one-er?
No, it's...
You like it?
We're not taking that to the meet.
How are we gonna get there?
I'll drive my car.
Why?
This business requires restraint. That is the opposite of restraint.
But I like it. I mean, I'm proud of it.
Good. And you be proud of it on your own time, but not with me. I'm not getting in that.
He would love us to tell Jonathan stories.
Oh, yeah. You got a Jonathan Banks stories?
Yeah.
Yeah. But also,
he couldn't be here.
This guy, this who's
Mark Croce is amazing.
Yes.
Playing Price.
Yeah.
Yes.
Look him up on YouTube.
Do this.
He haunted small time TV in a wonderful way. He went on all these local talk shows as a yo-yo champ who can't do anything.
Zim Yo-Yo Man.
It's like, yeah.
That's what it is.
Exactly.
Hey, Strauss.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like a Chris Elliott character. It's almost a guy who literally can't do anything, but has somehow, and it's real. I mean, they really, oh, we got a yo-yo expert. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. We'll put him on at 8:55.
It's like performance art. He told all these local news stations, like, he would go to small towns everywhere and say that he was a professional yo-yo artist.
Yeah, yes.
And was in town doing a show, and they would have him on, and he's, like, hitting people with the yo-yo. Can't do anything. And you see
Guaranteed.
The anchors, like, not sure, yeah. Like, oh, he's not very good.
Oh, I guess you have to warm up. You know, they say things like that. It's so wonderful.
Yeah, and they're like, do you want to take a break? He's like, I'm fine. It's just like everywhere. He's so funny.
He's great.
He's a great guy.
Jonathan Banks is America's badass, let's face it.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys, when he and Lee Marvin meet in heaven, hopefully a long, long time in the future, Lee's going to go, that's how badass Jonathan Banks is. And he's an amazing actor. He's one of those. I mean, you've seen it.
Yeah.
This guy's
lifetime
he's the goods. He's
and
the
a
goods.
Teddy bear in real life.
Yeah.
I know he doesn't want to tell anyone.
No, don't say that.
He is.
He's also very, 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 very dryly funny.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, like parched humor.
Yes.
This guy. And I actually met Jonathan Banks at the Lincoln Center played all of Breaking Bad, like a Breaking Bad marathon for like a month before the finale of the show. And I went to this reception, and Jonathan Banks was there with his daughter, who I think runs the social media accounts for Jonathan Banks.
Oh, Rebecca, yeah.
Yeah, and I went up to him, and I just introduced myself, and he said, I said, I'm a TV critic for New York Magazine, and he said, oh, have you written about the show? And I'm like, yeah, like, 650 times. And and I said, as a matter of fact, I tweeted about you just this morning, and he said, you tweeted about me. Yeah. And I said, yeah, kind of like, yeah. And he said, I'm not online. Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
It's like,
and it seems like I believed him.
Oh, yeah. No. He's a great guy. And it's so funny because people tend to, I found, approach actors, if they want to come up, a fan that wants to come up and talk to you, they tend to approach you in the vein of the character that you most recently played. So if you're playing a very open, accessible person, people will walk up to you more. If you're playing, like I played a Unabomber once, and people were like, oh, hey, hi, I love it. And then we went off. And so with Jonathan and Bob, we walked through town. And Bob is, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Hi.
Hey, he's back.
Don't you find that when we would go out to like the diner or something, Bob's playing this very gregarious, talkative person, and Bob's very generous and sweet, and I would say this even if he couldn't hear me, he's very kind and generous with fans, but can be a little more shy than they might expect as a person in real life, less gregarious and yelling, but they'll walk right up to him because they're just like, it's all, hey, blah, 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 and they're talking. So. Jonathan, they expect, like, he might shoot them. So I would literally be at a diner, and people are, like, talking to Bob, but they'd walk by Jonathan. There was a Marine, like, big guy that came by and just gave his business card, and he's like, I don't want to bother, I just want to tell you. And, like, slipped a card and ran away. And then the deal is, though, in real life, they're the opposite. While Bob can be pleasantly surprised by the fans and shy to accept the attention, Jonathan is like, get back over here and talk to me. Sit down. What are you doing? And, like, wants to talk to everybody. And it's just so, yeah, he's like your favorite weird uncle at every barbecue. I love it.
There's one footnote to that, though. Have you ever been with Jonathan in a restaurant and he doesn't like his food?
It's not good.
The look that he gives the you can imagine it. The look that he gives the waiter, he's just...
Right. And they're terrified.
And
terrified.
And once they are all the way at the table, before he has said anything, the guy has wet himself.
Totally.
And is on his way back to the kitchen with ups.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. And it's like he's using a kind of currency. It's, I mean, he's genuinely off-putting if he needs to be.
Yes.
And charming as hell.
Yes, and awesome. He uses them both to his advantage at all times. He also doesn't like being looked at by, like, stared at without them saying something. So he will. You can also be eating with them, and people will, like, be at the outside table and just try thinking they're being, like, covert and stare, and he will get up and be like, if you're going to stare at me, talk to me. Come talk to me. They're like, oh, Jesus. But he's so great, and he's so loving and generous, and he loves his job. Like, after, what did he say, 50 years in this business?
Just about, yeah.
He still loves it. He loves to prep for it. He loves to work on it. He loves to, you know, be there and work with other actors, and he's great.
Bob, are you still there?
Yeah.
Can you jump in on this? You've logged more screen time with Jonathan Banks than I think anybody on the show.
Not enough. I want more. Let's go. Let's get those two in the parking booth.
I meant with Breaking Bad included.
Yeah, listen, what can I say? He's the best. He's hilarious, and he brings all that energy, and very naturally falls into the role, although he is a super sweet guy in real life. He's a softie, I think.
Yeah.
You'd have to say. But honestly, I really do, when people ask me what do I hope happens next in the show, I hope that there's more scenes with me and with Jimmy and Mike, because together it really does feel like a comic duo, and
it really is.
The energy is. Yeah, I just can't help but giggle whenever my character is, you know, standing face to face with that guy, because they just hate each other and need each other, and it's just the best. So.
Yeah, there's sometimes when the two of you remind me of that Warner Brothers cartoon with the bulldog and the little dog that follows him around. What do you want to do today, Spike? Shut up. Yeah. I do hope you get more scenes with him.
We all do.
Yeah,
we all want scenes with Jonathan.
I'm still waiting. I can't even think of a way they would be in the same room, but work on it.
Jonathan and I, right?
You've got your notes for today.
Yeah, Jonathan and I want a scene together.
Too,
Kim's so reserved, we were like, would they just have a staring contest? Like, they're both very poker-faced about stuff.
We have the big wheel of characters. We go, okay, there we go. Mike and Kim.
Let's talk about Chuck and Kim versus Jimmy and Mike. In one respect, which is that we know eventually where two of these characters are going to end up. Mm-hmm. And we also know that they can't die. I don't think.
Jimmy and Mike can't, no. Right.
Yes, and so in a sense, for me at least, much of the suspense of the show is concentrated on you two characters because we don't know what's going to happen with you as people, but also they could kill you.
Mm-hmm. However... People also leave Albuquerque rather than dying.
It's, yeah.
that could happen too.
You know, I this is something that puzzled me for quite a while because people would ask and they'd always say, well, Kim dies, right? Or Chuck dies. And I at first I thought, well, that's a lack of imagination because there's a lot, as Michael says, there's a lot of things that can happen other than people being alive and dead. But then I think I've come to another conclusion, and you tell me if you guys agree. I think that they care, and they feel that these characters are in danger, because there's that question mark. And it's also because Jimmy, these are his two compass points. These are the two characters who he has the most invested in. There's deep connections between Jimmy and both these guys. So I actually think, to me, now I take that as a compliment or an admonishment not to take this too lightly. Because the idea, but there's a lot that can happen other than people.
Well, there is, and you know, I don't want to seem argumentative, but then I am a critic. You say there are other alternatives that they could just leave Albuquerque or something like that, but the audience loves these two characters so much that if you were to say, you know, Kim has moved to Saskatchewan, she's not on the show anymore, people would be mad at you.
Well, if we did it off screen, they would be. I'm just going to argue back.
Okay.
They would, you know, but anything you do has to be, you know, has to be played out dramatically.
I mean, sure.
It's, you know, we're all familiar with TV shows where character just disappears season to season, and the other characters, oh yeah, they moved. That's you know, because we couldn't make a contract with that person. And you know, that's what we want to avoid. Obviously, we have a lot. I don't know, personally, I feel like there's a lot more to say about both these folks.
Hmm. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I would hate to be invited to the panel to be fired. Listen. Listen, guys.
That would be epic.
Now there's a
Vulture would have a scoop.
Oh, that would
God.
Be amazing.
Oh, God.
I agree with you that I think people should have more. I was surprised at the number of people that thought there was only one conclusion. I was like, have you seen the writing of Vince and Peter? Like, there's a lot of possibilities. And you and Vince and Bob all addressed on one panel that we did that idea that, like, you only saw Saul in such specific circumstances during Breaking Bad that there's no reason why the two of us could exist or not exist in that world in some capacity. And people were like, but he never talked about his brother or Kim. And I was like, would you tell Tuco that you, like, by the way, I have a girlfriend. She's here at this address.
Yeah.
Like,
she's adorable.
I just thought, like, and which was such a great thing. There's so many possibilities to do with the Saul character because it was so contained. He was always in life or death circumstances in little tiny places with only the people that mattered in that scene.
This is a great pitch.
That's an interesting way to think about it, though, this idea that on a television show, when there are storylines and characters that we love, we want them to be present all the time. And I myself, as a viewer, experience this a lot. If one of my favorite characters is not on a show for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I start to get a little antsy. I start to get a little kind of resenting the show a little bit, like, where the hell is X? And some of the larger cast shows, it's almost inevitable that you're going to go a week or two without seeing a particular person. And I interviewed the showrunners of The Americans, and you know, within the course of a season, they'll be working different contacts, I guess, you know, trying to turn somebody or blackmail somebody. And there's a particular character I said is, so now that her storyline is done, and one of the guys said, well, you don't know that she's done. We're just not showing you what's going on. She could be back 6 months from now or a year from now or whatever. What do you do, you know, how do you handle that as a storyteller? Because sometimes shows run into trouble with that, where they feel like they have to service every character.
That is a problem. You know, it's certainly something we think about. We spend a lot of time talking about what's going on with each of these characters, but ultimately we have to show we have to go where the story takes us. If that makes any sense, we have to be. I mean, there's always, you know, we're in the writer's room. We're always, you know, you guys are talking about having scenes with Chuck and Mike or whatever. And we talk about those all the time. We come up with crazy scenarios, and it's a lot of but then if it defies logic, if human behavior doesn't follow the same lines, then we have to discard those. But having said that, you know, there have been, you know, the first episode last season two, there's no Chuck.
Right.
There's no Chuck.
And I was a little mad about it.
No Chuck in the episode.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, beginning of season one, there's very little Kim. And the wonderful thing that we have is that these actors have given us so much freedom and trust. We don't suddenly get calls from agents. Well, so why isn't Michael in this one? You know, we don't get they've given us the creative freedom, and we have mutual trust that somehow we're going to try to get it right. And I think the audience also understands that we try to make each episode is a unit, and we try to make each episode entertaining and complete in its own way. But we're telling a story that goes on, and sometimes the story takes you down little eddies, or you end up going, as we did at the end of season one, to Cicero for most of an episode, and so we had very little, and that killed me because I directed that one, and I had very little of these two guys in that episode, and I didn't like that, but it was where the story took us, and so that's not a great explanation, but I think as long as we try to keep in mind who these characters are and why they're doing what they're doing, I don't think we'll go far wrong. I hope not. That's served us so far.
I'd like to zero in on the storytelling a little bit more, which is, and talk about the look of the show, the feel of the show, the rhythm of the show, which is different from a lot of what you see on television drama in at least two respects. One of them is visually. There's a lot of thought put into every shot, every camera movement, every cut. This is true of Breaking Bad as well. And also the length of scenes. It's a one-hour show, which is, what, 42, 43 minutes?
I think we're more like 47.
47. Mm-hmm. That one.
Thank you, AMC.
Subtract the ads, yes. Right? But within that, it's not like there are many dramas, which for the moment will be unnamed, where scenes will be 30 seconds, 45 seconds,
right. Yeah.
A minute. This show doesn't usually do that. You'll stay in a scene. It feels like they're more shaped. And within that, there's a sense of architecture to how the scenes are built. What I'm wondering is, how do you integrate that with the performances? Because I've heard from a number of actors who've worked with highly controlled filmmakers, like people like Tim Burton or Steven Spielberg or someone like that. They enjoy the experience, they're proud of their work on it, but there's also something that can be frustrating about it because you're acting in pieces. You're acting right. For this shot, for that shot, and it's like, now we've gotten that little 5-second piece that we need, and now we're going to completely relight the set, and we're going to come in from this angle and do this other thing. How do you reconcile all of that? I mean, you can't just stick the camera on a tripod and say, now act the scene, guys. A lot of shows can. You've committed not to do that.
You know, we have... There's a big question. We are very fortunate in that we have... an incredible group of filmmakers working on the show. We have wonderful directors. You saw two clips there so far. You've shown one from Michelle McLaren, who is just an astounding director and
one of the best action filmmakers in the world.
Yes,
tell me about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
and then you have Tom Schnauz, who directed wrote and directed the last clip that they showed. These are people who really care deeply about how the story is told visually, and so that's very important. But and we also have Arthur Albert and his team, and Arthur Albert's our DP, and
he's
incredible.
Yeah.
He's an incredible DP and a wonderful human being. Everybody really cares about the way the show looks. I don't think it's interesting because the way you say it sounds almost in opposition. That here we have the way the show's presented visually, and here we have performance. I don't really feel that those two things are in opposition myself.
Right.
I think that, and especially when you have actors, and you have two actors up here who are both incredible stage actors. These are incredible performers in live situations as well as in film. They can do anything that we ask of them. I mean, they really have such ability and facility in what they do, that it's not like we're asking people to, hopefully not asking them to restrain themselves because of the way the show is shot, and that's also, I think, that to a great extent, that's the job of the director, is to have be able to capture the performance and also capture it in a visual context. So I don't really think those two things are in opposition to me. But, and the other thing, though, is...
Maybe on your set, they're not.
But in the end, when we're sitting in the editing room, by the way, we have to also mention our editors.
Right. Yeah.
Skip, led by Kelly Dixon and Skip McDonald. They have a wonderful sensitivity to the characters and the performance. And if we get into the editing room and we have some clever visual idea, but it undermines the moment, or if it's not the best moment for the performer. I personally, and fortunately, Vince and I have pretty much good final say over this. We'll go for the performance. We'll go for the character. But having said that, these guys give us something wonderful from every angle. And I'm not blowing smoke. It's oftentimes, and I was lucky enough to get direct both of them in a scene together late in last season. And the hardest thing about editing that scene was that there was something wonderful and something different from every angle.
The three-way confrontation, episode 9,
where Kim finally tells Chuck off.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was one of the challenges of the scene, because we had. I shot the hell out of it, and these guys acted the hell out of it, and then we had to just decide where we wanted to be, because everywhere we could be, there was something interesting. And so much of that is just attributable to the fact that they do such detailed work, and they also come in prepared. And on a television schedule, Bob. Looking up like he's
somewhere.
In the sky. Bob works every weekend. He, you know, there's usually each week there's usually a couple of big scenes, and the cast will get together.
We rehearse off campus,
and that, boy, I'll tell you, that makes a huge difference, because when you come in and you say, well, can you show me? I know you guys worked on this. Can you show me what you did? And they go, oh, okay, great. This is going to be great. All I have to do is shoot it.
Well, it's also two things. I feel like none of us wants the words to get in the way, because you're right. These are 8 and 10 page dialogue scenes,
oh, yeah.
Which is unusual. And you want to get there and you want to be able to play with everything except trying to remember your line, because it just hinders you. You don't get as much time to play and make up different ways to do it. And I don't know about you, but I feel like some of what you're talking about visually, whether they're extreme angles or using cinematic wides, which is also unusual on television,
yes.
Certainly before Breaking Bad, and now both of our shows use them. Maybe it is, because I think our entire cast is stage performers, so there's a comfort level to playing a full scene as though it's a play, and getting to play it with your whole body, knowing that your dramatic or sometimes dark comedic moment isn't going to be here.
Mm-hmm.
You can, if the best way to play it is the slope of the shoulders instead of squeezing out a tear, that's going to be allowed too, and that's going to be on film and might be the cut that's used. And there, I find freedom in that. I also find freedom in the fact that AMC and Sony do not note them to death, so we don't get rewrites, which is unheard of. You get a script, and you get to go rehearse it, and that's it. There will be no rewrites. I don't know if any of you guys know, like, often you'll get a scene and you can start to work on it, but it most likely will be slightly altered to very altered the next day. And every day a network is watching it be rehearsed or watching a daily and then giving notes and changing it, and the actor's trying to keep up. And so you can't marry yourself to beats in a scene. We're getting 8 to 10 page dialogue, beautiful plays, beautiful like little short films in and of themselves. And then there's freedom when we get there, because now we're going to just spend our time doing it 50 different ways and finding the right, like you said, the architecture of what the storyline is.
And it's much more fun than doing those scenes that last 30 seconds.
Absolutely.
Because then you feel like an accomplice in a cheat. If you see a scene and it's, oh, I get this, this is a page and a half, and it ends with someone looking at the other person and going, do I, Steve? Do I? And that's all we need, folks, because nobody gives a shit. And it's not like that. The other point is, there are people, and thank God we don't have this, but there are people who are very, very, very good writers who are not getting notes from the studio or from the network, but are rewriting constantly anyway. You know, there are people who autonomously say, you know what, that big speech that you got on page 6 here, I've totally changed it, and we shoot in 30 seconds. And it's like, that's...
You worked for David Milch then.
Yeah, oh, Okay, I wasn't going to mention that. No, actually, my one experience with Milch was exactly the opposite. But I had heard that he would do that on Deadwood, that he would, Jim Beaver was talking about that he would, like, suddenly say, yeah, I wrote this this morning around 4, and I'd like you to do this instead of this other one. And then it's like, well, okay, thank God I'm a robot, so I can do that, you know. But whatever the case, I mean, Milch's stuff hits the air looking pretty damn good. So yeah, it's like there are all different kinds of processes.
True.
But like I say, that it's so much more fun to work on an 8-page scene that is about the way human beings really do interact with one another, rather than something that looks like a clip reel. You know,
yeah.
it's a different deal.
And then our directors and our editors allow us to breathe in the scenes, which is also unusual. You can hold, and it's not going to be cut. You can know that.
Right.
My scenes with Bob, there's so much more that's between the lines than on the lines, which I think portrays history of a relationship. Mm-hmm. It's what doesn't have to be said. We're able to do that and know in our hearts that it's not gonna get cut. They're not gonna try to make it like snippy. They're gonna try to let it breathe.
Yes, you know, you and Peter have both mentioned theater, and something kind of clicked for me when you said that, because that is an area where you can have an extremely controlled visual,
mm-hmm.
very very exact from moment to moment, and also have long scenes where things can breathe. And something about the lighting on the show often looks theatrical to me.
Mm-hmm.
Where there'll be like three, you'll see a wide shot and three quarters of the frame will be black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it almost looks like there's a spotlight on Kim or on Chuck or something like that. Or old movies. Old movies are also...
Yeah, film noir looking stuff.
Yeah. Do you talk about old movies? Do you think about old movies when you're working on this show?
Yeah, I mean, we talk more about probably old movies than anything else. We quote dialogue to each other. Your movies, this is special for me to be right here at where we are at Melk, because I grew up about 3 blocks from here going to what is now the Joyce, but at the time I think was called the Elgin. Seeing it was a revival house, and getting to see, this was of course a period before home video. New York was filled with old movies. There was the Elgin, the 8th Street Playhouse. There's the Thalia, which I think still exists.
Yes.
And those for me were the formative experiences, was watching movies that were made mostly before I was born. A lot of them, you know, Silence, the movies from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And those are things that we talk about in the writer's room. We talk, there's certain movies, well, through the 70s too, certainly on Breaking Bad, The Godfather was something that we, that's sort of the text for people of my generation and filmmakers of my generation, and certainly one of our touchstones on that show. But this show, a lot of this show has influences in things like Billy Wilder movies, or there are a few moments that really feel like that, or movies from the 40s, the Preston Sturges films. I feel like one of the things I love about Kim is that she seems to me in some ways to be in that tradition of characters, female characters who really control the tiller of their own ship, who are self-contained, who are with the people they're with because they want to be, not because they have to be. Something about Ray. It's something about Ray, and right now, in fact, your hair. All feels like a echo of that.
First time I've been told I'm from the wrong era.
So many of us. So that's absolutely old movies are. I mean, those are very important to all of us in the writers' room. We have a lot of film buffs in the writers' room. A lot of people film buffs from different eras, though, and that's one of the things that's terrific about it. Whereas I tend to skew, I'll be the one who talks about Vorkapitch, and then we have also some folks who are more contemporary in their taste, which is good.
I think we have time for some questions. Could we do that? If you have any questions,
can we make the lighting more oppressive?
Yeah, yes.
There was a moment there I wasn't squinting at all. It really threw me.
But if you will raise your hand, but wait, we have microphones that will be brought to you. So if you could wait for the microphone, Maybe start here in the front. Can we do that?
Oh, wow, there are people out there.
Okay.
Okay, you will get quieter as you speak into the microphone.
Okay, I'll try to be extra loud then.
Better.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you from all the fans for creating such an awesome show. Really makes it easy for us to be fans, and we all, I think I can collectively say, we all love this show. So thank you. Thank you all. Thank you, Bob, in the sky.
You're welcome.
So my question, I guess, actually is for Peter. At the beginning of this conversation, you said there's no happy endings in showbiz. But I wanted to ask you whether there was the potential for any happy endings in the Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul universe for anybody at all.
Oh, I think so. I don't think anything's predetermined. At least not. We try not to. I don't think so. We have the. You know, even with Breaking Bad, we had a story that was set up by Vince from the beginning. As Mr. Chips turns into Scarface, this show we have Jimmy McGill become Saul Goodman, which in some ways seems it's not quite as extreme a journey. It's a different kind of journey. But then we also have the fact that this character is, we also see his gene in Omaha, Nebraska, working at a Cinnabon. And so that, to me, that hints that maybe there's more to the story after Breaking Bad. So we'll see.
I had actually wondered about that in the context of old movies. Like, this we could be in for a third man ending, maybe. Harry Lime comes back.
Harry Lime. Mm.
Yeah. Sorry, I spoiled it for you, but 1948, so deal.
Yes. Not really dead.
Yeah. Anybody else? Actually, back there in the middle. Right there. He's just 5 more seconds. He'll give you a mic.
An attorney who needs a microphone.
As an attorney.
There's trouble there.
Those are three terrifying words.
As an attorney.
As an attorney, I'm very intrigued by how much practicing law is part of the show. Do you get some sort of counsel from lawyers on, okay, Kim should be doing doc review, all the different legal aspects of the show? Where do you get the nitty-gritty details from?
Absolutely. One of the things I'm so proud of is the fact that we have a law show that concerns, the legal cases are, old folks getting overcharged for toilet paper. There's drunken disorderly. Then there's interstate banking regulation.
Solicitation.
One of our great concerns going into this was that it would be a law show, because neither Vince nor I have that bent. We don't have that procedural bent, and we don't know, sure as hell don't know anything about law. Luckily, we've had a lot of help, and fortunately, we have some folks in the writers' room who are from families of lawyers, especially Gordon Smith. Both his mother and his sister are attorneys, and we've had a lot of attorneys come and help us out. Interestingly enough, with different parts of the law. Season one, there was more about sort of small-scale criminal law, moving into larger cases. And then season two, we had to learn about things like doc review.
Right.
Which, we just tried to find out, what's the bad job that Kim would get. If she was out of favor, and so that.
But then I spent a morning with, like, they brought in someone that literally showed you how you catalog those things and stamp them all and code them and what you would highlight and how you would put it back in a box with a marker, because it needed to look like something that somebody has done a million times that they can do without thinking.
And all those documents actually had. That all had text that was relevant, that was written by our folks back in Burbank, led by Ariel Levine, who was at the time, I think, I don't know what she was then, but now she's our writer's assistant. And she and some of the other folks in the office wrote hundreds of pages of legal documents for you to overline.
Yep.
Yes, and for you to read when you were doing the big banking meeting.
Well, here's a little secret. I can't read a thing without my glasses.
Yes.
So, I mean, I'm just faking it. I wasn't really taking anything in. Everything else I do is real, but the reading is totally fake.
Right on.
It could say Michael McKean's an asshole on every page, and I would not know it. I mean, I'd know it, but I wouldn't know it from reading.
This is very useful. Good to know. No.
My friend Alan Sepinwall likes to imagine an alternate universe where you and Vince Gilligan do this show first. And he wants to see the pitch meeting where you propose Jimmy McGill, elder care lawyer.
That's funny.
You got another one? You here in the front row? This lady right here.
Hello. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm also a lawyer, not from this country. And I find it very interesting how you've got a very, what I would consider a very, in the Chuck character, a very sort of rule-oriented and very, very sort of procedural and knowledgeable person, and then this very extreme other character. And I wondered, did you actually model this on these two characters on actual lawyers that you think of, or are you just thinking that they're ordinary people that just happen to be lawyers?
Wow. No, I take everything off the pages that we get from these guys. I had no... I had no model in my head about what this lawyer was. And I just, I count on them. Everything I saw before me felt genuine. And again, they didn't pitch me the entire season, you know, before. I didn't know where it was going.
Neither did we.
Right, exactly. That's why. I remember when we were doing the fifth or sixth show and you called... And you know, you and Vince called and told me about the show where it was the ninth episode of the first season, where it was kind of revealed that Chuck's been working behind the scenes to dynamite Jimmy's progress, which is a polite way of putting it. But it all made sense, and it was almost like well, we're giving you a heads up here of it's going to take a turn. I didn't see the turn. I didn't see it coming necessarily. But it all made sense. So, you know, I repeat myself, but it really is on the page. And, you know, they tell me when I'm on the right track by putting it in the show.
Well, that's exactly right. One of the glories of this particular kind of writing and filmmaking is that we get to watch the performances and learn about the characters from the way the actors interpret the characters. And, you know, I think Kim was shaped a lot by Ray's interpretation of Kim. And likewise, Michael, when we started the season one, Vince and I had written the scene between Chuck and Jimmy, and there was a dimension to what you did in the scene and in the subsequent scenes that I hadn't anticipated. I don't think we anticipated, which was, and I think it was, maybe you could argue it was there in the writing, but we didn't see it until you did it. And it was Chuck's kind of gravitas and his pride and what a person he is to be reckoned with. And then we asked ourselves, well, how does this guy feel about having Jimmy McGill for a brother? And that, in a lot of ways, that insight has led to almost everything that we've done since. Hmm. But if we had to write the whole season, as I know some people do, and then shoot it, we would have never come to that. We would have never been able to watch what we were seeing coming in from the set, or watch the rehearsals and go, wait a minute, I see something else in this person, something that I wasn't expecting, and then write to that.
Can I follow up on that by asking you, have you or any of the other writers on the show taken a character in a different direction or given a character some different bit of business or some new ability based on the actors?
Oh,
based on conversations with the actors?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you give me an example of some, a couple of...
Well, Bob, I don't know if you're there.
Yeah.
But Bob is... You're well known for your British accents, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're incredibly good British accents, is that right?
I'm renowned for being able to cram all the various accents of Britain into one sentence.
And I believe you're also known for your singing ability. Is that
yes,
true?
Yes, I am. Equally, yes, sir. I am used as a reference point. I don't know what.
So
what
know,
not to do.
So since we know this about Bob, anytime that we can have him sing or do a British accent, those are certainly things that Michael is so musical that having him play the piano was a natural
fake.
But he can play really well.
Yes, but you are musical, though.
I play the guitar.
You play the guitar. Well, if we had had a guitar when we...
No, Begley got the guitar. Begley. We always saw Begley get the guitar.
And he can't play at all.
He's a drummer.
Begley can't play, right?
And because he's a drummer.
He's a drummer.
So you guys got to get your shit together as far as that goes. I'm sorry.
Bob is a renowned bagpipe player, though.
He is.
Also.
He is a renowned bagpipe. We want to get you out of your comfort zone.
Great. Anybody else? Let's try somebody in the back. Way in the back. Way in the back. Right there. Yes, I see you waving your hand. Yes,
yep.
Yes, that's you. Keep it in the air so they can bring you the microphone. Yes. All right.
Hi. Thank you. This is a question for Peter. How has the writing process for Better Call Saul differ from Breaking Bad by virtue of it being a prequel? And what I mean by that is, are there certain threads or plot threads that you in the writer's room wanted to go down, but then you realize we can't retcon or we can't contradict this background detail that we introduced in Breaking Bad? And does that force you to be a bit more creative with how you, you know, develop different ideas and storylines, but still be within the lines, at least? Like, we want Mike to shoot Hector Salamanca, but we know that he can't by virtue of Hector still being alive. We know that Jimmy never meets Gus. So how does that force you to sort of like develop, maybe work a little bit backwards?
Well, you picked out two great examples there. We have 62 episodes of Breaking Bad that we've decided we want to abide by. I've had people pitch to me that actually maybe Jimmy never becomes Saul Goodman, and that just, you know, it just turns out this is an alternate take, an alternate universe. But we're squares, so we won't do that. It's absolutely true that there are times. I mean, it makes our lives incredibly difficult that some of these characters never met each other. There are characters we'd love to have on from Breaking Bad who we just know met Jimmy or slash Saul for the first time on Breaking Bad. So it's always something that we have, and we will come up with pitches, and I'm one of the biggest offenders, and I'll come up with a pitch, and then someone will have to say, well, it always seemed like, you know, it always seemed like Jimmy didn't know this character or that character, or Saul didn't know this character or that character. And so, you know, those wonderful pitches will have to go in the trash for the moment. So the good thing, though, however, having said all that, is that it gives us a frame in which to work with. And as you said, I think sometimes certain limitations actually force you to be a little bit more creative. So sometimes that's a good thing. We experience this. We do this all the time to ourselves. We experience this. The example I remember on Breaking Bad was that we had in the fifth season, we had this machine gun. We flashed forward and we saw Walt with a beard, and the house was all destroyed. And then in his trunk, he had this machine gun. Right? That's more or less how it went. And we had no idea how he was going to use the machine gun or who he was going to use it on. And I can't tell you how many times in the writer's room Vince would say, "Oh, what we could do anything if we just didn't have that." He used a different word. That machine gun in the trunk. That fucking machine gun in the trunk. And we keep doing this to ourselves because now we have Omaha, and we know certain things about Omaha that we've learned, and the disappearer, and there's all kinds of things that we know that we have that we want to abide by. We know a little bit about Chuck's wife Rebecca. That we've seen, and these are all things that are limitations, but they often turn out to be the seeds of ideas. And one of the tricks that I think we learned on Breaking Bad was a lot of the time when people talk about writing, they talk about going in the future and think about where you're going and okay, we're going to put these landmarks up in the future, and this is where we're going to go, and the characters are going to do this and that and the other thing, and that's valuable in itself. But the thing that I don't hear people talking about that I think is just as valuable is going backwards in your story and saying, what was it that they said about this? What was that look that Kim gave Jimmy in that particular scene? What did that mean? Or you know, I always thought this about the way these two characters were, but maybe there's another way to look at it. We spent a lot of time actually going over territory that we've already been in, and trying to figure out if there's more use to be made of material that's already been on the show. And I think that's one of the things that hopefully makes it feel, as much as we can, makes it feel like an integrated whole.
I'm so relieved by what you said, because somebody built a very convincing case to me one time that this entire show was Saul's just extended fantasy while he was working at Cinnabon.
Uh-huh.
And that was about the saddest thing I've ever heard in my life. So,
would you guys find that satisfying? Show of hands.
Yeah, well, there goes that. Yeah. One more. In the middle with the wristband.
They all have wristbands.
They all have wristbands.
The worst description ever.
The person with the hand.
In the ballroom with the knife.
Let's give it to the person with the hand.
The silhouetted figure.
Yes.
Hi, thanks again for doing this. One of my favorite parts of this season was the montages that we see. I'm thinking of Kim and the rainbow post-it notes drumming up.
Oh, my God, what a great scene.
Or Jimmy trying to get fired with the wacky inflatable arm man. I'm just hoping you can talk a little bit about how you conceive these montages and what it's like to execute them.
Well, conceive them, I mean...
Well, talk about what it's like. What was it like to do the Kim with the post-it notes?
So much fun. The episode, that's five, right? Rebecca. When...
written by Ann Cherkis and directed
yes.
by John Scheiben.
Yes, right? And so you have that great... And then she wrote that great scene that starts at my journey in that one with the You Don't Save Me, I Save Me, which was also such a lovely scene to play. But then we go into this... Kim's like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make I am fixing this myself. This motto that she clings to for dear life of like, I can fix myself. So there was this huge montage scene, and it was mostly me by myself that day. And we had there was nine phone calls in total, plus pocket dialogue, which is text that's written, script that's written past where you're talking that they could use as additional dialogue, but probably going to take pieces. So there could be music over it, or they're going to cut in and out of it, but you need to do all of it and act all of it. So it was about nine phone calls plus. And then you said that you wanted it to look like it took place probably over 4 days. She doesn't have an office anymore, so there are various locations trying to find some degree of privacy. So that meant that we took all of those phone calls and shot portions of them over and over in four different outfits in a variety of locations, which actually takes a long time. It doesn't seem like it would, but it would. It does. And the crew was awesome. It was an awesome day because the crew, it became like a pit crew, because to get it done in like 12 hours, you're also looking for a place to put on a new mic and changing the costume, and then makeup and hair has got to fix that. And props people are trying to remember which color post-it I had with which name on it and where it went. And I, to keep the phone calls straight so that they look real, I wrote the other half of all of them. I wrote the dialogue that the person would be saying back to me so that I could keep straight. You know, a cold call to a friend's mom in college is different than a guy that I hang out with told me his boss might have a case for me. You know, there's right. varying degrees of cold calls and how you would speak to somebody and what they're saying back to you. So I'm trying to keep that straight with the names that are on the post-it. And if they had turned the camera around, you've got literally like this pit crew trying to change me as fast as they can and tell me what day it is and who am I? And I was like... Oh, and then there were some names that didn't clear. And in my weird brain, I had made like, okay, the Ann Loop one or whatever, like that's the doctor that my mom used to go to that I know a little bit and met him once, but he's kind of weird. And then they're like, ah, this has to be Chris now. And I was like, it can't be Chris. Chris is not on the pink post. And I'm freaking out. So I calmed down. And then, they were amazing. And everybody helped me do it. And then to get to, as Bob said earlier, it is an amazing experience to think you know what you shot and then see what Kelly Dixon or Skip McDonald or Chris Caleb in season one does with it. And the fact that she displaced my dialogue from me speaking, there's times in the montage where the dialogue is not matching my mouth, and it's even more disconcerting. You even get more how much work Kim was trying to do, and the My Way was brilliant. Who picked that?
That was John Scheiben's choice, I believe.
That was so great.
What impressed me about that scene in particular was that I knew you were speaking to a different person each time you were.
Okay.
There was nothing, there were no two phone calls that were alike, because there are no two people that you're exactly alike with on the phone. The different level of, I know you from this and this, and I don't you remember we met here, or we've known each other for 15 years, whatever it happens to be. The timbre of the scene worked for me, along with the brilliant cutting. It was, every phone call was a real phone call.
Thanks.
And I was
That's
really
Michael
impressed.
McKean.
That is That is a great scene, and also because it's about two things that television doesn't usually dwell on, which is work, the actual details of work, and making something happen, and rejection.
Yeah.
A lot of rejection on the show, and you see her powering through it.
And then you see the case taken away from me, and that which beautiful line that Arthur did,
that
where I'm left standing there by myself.
And
I love the number of lawyers that have come up to me and said, because you're not, it's right, you're not, it's not, you're right, it's not a procedural. So we do some scenes with legalese, but by and large, the lawyers that have reached out to me have said, like, thank you for showing the work it takes, like the actual grunt work and the politics of the hierarchy of getting ahead and getting squashed back down and all of that stuff. We pay a lot of attention to detail to that.
I think we have time for one more question, then we have to wrap it up. Let's, right here. Wait for the mic. She's right here in the front. Okay.
Could you shed some light on Chuck's illness and what's going on there? Is that real? Where did that come
from?
But
not electrical light.
When I first accepted this part without having read anything, just because I knew it was you know, Vince and Peter. I'd worked with Vince once before on X-Files, and I liked him a lot, and we talked over the years. So this time it all worked out. I was going to do this show. I said yes, of course. And then I started worrying about what this affliction was. All I knew was there was an affliction that kept him in the house. So my nightmare was, oh yeah, he's got psoriasis, head to toe, open, oozing sores. And you know, we're probably gonna get it down to 5 hours of makeup a day. So, and then when they told me what the affliction was, I said, is this a real thing? I said, what did you do? It was a real thing. They said, yeah, it's a real thing, but we don't really know to what degree the suffering is, you know, it seemed like they weren't nailed down. So I played it along with the not nailed down sounded like a good place to go. But as an actor, I have to take it all as real, because there are scenes where nobody else is watching. Mm-hmm. There are scenes when only the people at home are seeing me all alone and still suffering. So it's not something I'm faking, but it's definitely something that's real to me. That particular associative part of Chuck's mind is still unexplored territory. So I don't have a definitive answer, but Michael, the actor, has to work with Chuck, the sick man, because it's real to Chuck, and that's all we know.
I always wondered if that was his way of shutting out the corruption of the world.
I don't
in
know.
In a way, like that was some well, kind of like, you know?
He's sitting in a great deal of corruption himself.
He is.
All alone, so, you know, you don't have to send out for corruption if you have.
Yeah. He's right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you for coming out, everybody. Really appreciate it. Thank you to the panel.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
That's it for this week's Vulture TV podcast. Don't forget to email us your questions or comments at tvquestions@vulture.com or leave us a voicemail at 646-504-7673. The Vulture TV podcast is produced by Sam Dingman. Laura Mayer is our managing producer, and Andy Bowers is our chief content officer. The Vulture TV podcast is part of the Panoply Network. I'm Gazelle Amami, and you can find me on Twitter @Gazellephant. Thanks for listening.